With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Before World War II, Herbert Zukers was a famous figure in a small Latvian town. He was sort of the Charles Lindbergh of his country, this dashing figure. But by 1945, he was known as the Butcher of Latvia, someone who murdered about 30,000 Latvian Jews. He managed to escape the Nuremberg trials and fled to South America after the war's end. By 1965, a statute of limitations on all Nazi war criminals was about to expire, so Germany sought to welcome previous concentration camp commanders, pogrom leaders, and executioners as citizens. In order to beat this deadline, there was a global pursuit of Nazi criminals. And Mossad, the Israeli National Intelligence Agency, joined the cause. Yaakov Medad, who was the Mossad agent who kidnapped Adolf Eichmann 3 years earlier, led the mission to assassinate Zukers in a bid to block the amnesty. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Talty, author of the book The Good Assassin, that uncovers this little-known chapter of Holocaust history and the undercover operation that eventually brought Zukers to justice. Medad had to travel to Brazil in an elaborate disguise and befriend Zukers and earn his trust before being able to execute the operation. This episode is a look into how war criminals try to escape justice, international spy operations, and all other things that made the mid-20th century so sensational. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Stephen Talty. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, I'm very fascinated with this story, but I have a question for you in general about this topic. There's a strong interest in stories about hunting Nazis. There's the Amazon show Hunters. There was the movie a couple of years ago with Oscar Isaac, Operation Finale, about Adolf Eichmann in South America. But my question is, every war produces war criminals that would probably try to escape justice. So why do you think stories like these about the hunt for Nazis interest people so much compared to war criminals from the Balkans or other conflicts?
Well, I think the Nazi regime was uniquely evil, and people found it hard to forget what had been perpetrated during that era. I think that's really the main thing, that these, especially the officers, you know, the guys who really directed and led these slaughters and these massacres, were of special interest to people who felt perhaps that Nuremberg didn't capture and put on trial all the perpetrators of the Holocaust. So I think there was a sense that people were getting away with it in a certain sense. And I also think that there was an idea that Germany propagated after the war that the Holocaust was sort of the product of Hitler and a few of his lieutenants who kind of hypnotized the German people. And I think people sensed that was not correct, that there was a far larger participation of Germans and even other nationalities in the crimes, and they wanted to see those people punished. So when they fled to South America, especially, and tried to assume new names, and really there was not a lot of follow-up after Nuremberg, after the trials there. So people just felt that people who had done really terrible things had gotten away with it.
Well, there are a lot of stories that are well known, like Adolf Eichmann and other high-ranking Nazis who escaped via rat lines to South America. But I'd never heard of Herbert Zukers before. So who is he, and what was it about his story that inspired you to write about him?
Well, Zukers was called Latvian Lindbergh. He came from Latvia, the small country that's sort of tucked on the side of Russia. And he had really, before the war, he had been a national hero. He built his own airplanes. He'd flown to Africa and to Japan. Really a daring, courageous guy. So he was famous in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe. And he was also friendly with Jews. He would be seen drinking with them in the cafes in Riga, the capital. So he had this reputation as kind of an adventurer, somebody who really made his own way in the world. But when the war came, he became the savage killer and led commando units killing 30,000 Jews in Latvia. So to me, the first thing that attracted me was this incredible kind of turnaround in his reputation. Like, why, what had caused him to go from like the Latvian Lindbergh into this mass murderer?
What do you think the reason was? Because you mentioned that he was friendly with Jews before the war and would speak with intellectuals at the time, and they were many seen as part of the intellectual class in the 1930s. What do you think triggered that change?
Well, that was really one of the objects of my research, and it took me months and months to sort of peel away what had happened back then. But I think what had really happened is that just before the Germans invaded, the Soviets had occupied Latvia, and Herbert Zukers had turned out to be a collaborator with the Russians. So the Soviet occupation was hugely unpopular among the native population. And when the Germans came in, it was really kind of like an uprising against the collaborators. So Zukers saw that he had to do something really to protect his own life. And what he did was cooperate with the German regime. And that's really what led to his participation in the slaughters.
What was it that he did in particular that later on made him a target for Mossad and others to track him down when he was considered to have committed notorious war crimes?
Well, the first thing he did was to be famous, basically. I mean, I can't say that he was unique in what he did, but the fact that he was kind of a national hero focused attention on him. And then what he did was he turned on his former friends and neighbors. He would point them out. He would lead patrols into the buildings where Jewish families lived. He would drag them out, and he would lead them to the slaughter. He would take them to the pits in the forest near Riga, not only supervise the executions, but take part of them himself. So he was not only kind of a workman, kind of a henchman of the Germans, but he was also leading these patrols, betraying people. And I think that's what the Latvians really found so offensive, is that this guy that they had admired and they had sort of befriended before the war turned on them so viciously.
After the war ends, he goes to South America, and there are many ways that Nazis would escape the so-called rat lines by means of getting to South America and fleeing justice. So how does he go about doing that?
Well, he was not on any of the lists. He was not. His crimes were not as well known as sort of the German names that were on the American and British lists of people to arrest. So he got through the American lines, made his way to France, and there, with the help of the Catholic Church, actually, he got a completely legal visa to Brazil and sailed for Rio. So he didn't really rely on these networks or underground sort of conduits. He sort of did it on his own and actually went under his own name, which was highly unusual at the time.
Yeah, I'm interested with the Catholic Church. Correct me if I'm wrong, but were they providing visas, especially those from Eastern Europe who were claiming that they were escaping Soviet persecution and couldn't practice their faith? Was that the reason, or was there some other collaboration angle going on here?
No, I think that was the reason. And that's what Zukers sort of, that's what his story after the war became, that he had been a victim of Soviet oppression, and that he had actually fought against the Nazis. So I don't think at that point in the chaos of the post-war period that the Catholic Church was looking too deeply into, the backstories of these guys that were claiming that they were, that they were victimized for their own faith. So I don't think there was a conspiracy there, but certainly he should have been held by the Americans or the British immediately after the war. But as I said, you know, the sort of the fog of the post-war period kind of prevented that.
What did it look like when you researched his period in South America? And I'm curious because this is fictionalized by people like the movie The Boys in Brazil about eugenics experiments in South America to bring back Hitler, or even X-Men movies where Magneto hunts down Nazis in South America. But what's he doing down there? Is he with other Germans? Is he just trying to quietly lead his own life?
He is, but he's kind of unique in that, you know, there were very few Latvians in South America, especially in Brazil during the time. So he kind of had carte blanche to create his own myth. And what he did was incredibly risky. He came with a Jewish girl that had sort of lived with him during the war period, and he kind of used it, her as his kind of golden ticket. He would say, "I saved this woman during the war." He basically projected himself as a hero of the Nazi resistance. And he would actually seek out German groups and German leaders in the community, and they were delighted to meet him. They just thought he was one of these righteous Gentiles who had sort of saved Jews during the war. So what got Zucker in trouble kind of immediately was this thirst for fame. I don't think he was done with being the Latvian Lindbergh. He loved the glory. He loved the fame. And he kind of sought out publicity, and it kind of led to his downfall in the end.
Do you have a sense of what his relationship was like with this Jewish woman? And how do you have that when a person who collaborates with the Nazis is now dating someone who is considered of a lower racial stock, according to the Aryan viewpoint of the time?
Yeah, I mean, I was able to sort of unearth the story of this woman, and he'd actually kept her as a kind of slave, an occupied Jewish apartment that he took over after the Germans came in. So it wasn't a relationship in the terms that we would think of. He used her sexually, and other officers in the commando unit did the same. So she, out of fear of her own life, went along with his story and along with his kind of tall tales. And of course, she wasn't sort of seeing what he was doing on the outside. So she might have believed part of his stories, but it was a very unequal relationship. You know, he was definitely a victimizer. And I found eyewitness testimony of how he treated her during the war. And it didn't match up with his post-war stories at all.
When we get to 1965, this is really where you focus on in your book. And the statute of limitations on Nazi war crimes is about to run out because Germany sets this date. So why does Germany set this particular date?
Well, it had dated from the Weimar Republic, and it had dated from 1871 when there was simply a statute of limitations put on all kinds of murders. So, you know, this was something that was designed for peacetime, for sort of garden variety murders, you know, like a romantic rival killing a guy, or somebody killing someone in a rage. So it was not intended for really a word that hadn't been invented yet, which was genocide. So very few people believed that Germans would enforce it because it had been sort of, the law had been written under such different circumstances. But they announced that they intended to go ahead with it, which meant that any German criminals who had sort of committed murder or mass murder during the war and had not yet been indicted would go totally free. They could never be convicted. So that's what really enraged people around the world, not only Jewish groups, but the American government, the British government. MPs protested. There were really global protests against this movement.
So what was it about Zucker's that got on the radar of Mossad? Was it because he was living under his own name, still trying to mythologize his past, or some other reason?
That was one of the things. First of all, it was a practical reason. He was easy to locate because he was living under his own name. They knew where he was. They knew he was in Rio. I think the other thing was that some of the stories from the eyewitnesses they had were just so savage that he could become the face of the Holocaust, the face of the collaborators who did the actual killing. And there were also some personal connections. One of the Israeli generals who was reviewing the list of people that could become targets for Mossad had some of his family killed in Latvia. So there was kind of a personal motive there. But the main reason was that he was accessible, and that they knew once his crimes were publicized that this idea of giving an amnesty to these kinds of men would be much less palatable for the Germans.
What does the manhunt look like when Mossad is specifically going out to try to capture him?
Well, the complication in the mission was that they wanted to get him to another country. Brazil had a right-wing government at the time. It had a lot of Jewish refugees and Jewish residents. So they didn't want to assassinate him in Brazil. So they knew that they had to sort of entice him or befriend him to get him to perhaps Chile or Uruguay, where they could finish the mission and execute him. So it was more than sort of like taking a sniper rifle and shooting him in the street. They wanted sort of almost like a formal process. They wanted to read him a verdict, letting him know why he was being killed, and sort of make it kind of semi-judicial in that sense. So it had to be a much more elaborate operation than sort of like sending in a kill team. And that's what led to the participation of Mio, which was the agent who led the operation.
The manhunt, is this similar or different to other targets, former SS officers that were on the radar of these groups?
It wasn't different. He had a similar profile. He was kind of middle management, if you will, the same as some SS officers. It was more the fact that they had to have an agent with a cover story and actually approach him and really befriend him. That was sort of the crux of the operation. They had to make him believe that this agent was an Austrian businessman who's looking to make his fortune in South America, and that Zucchers could sort of profit by that. So enticing this guy who was very suspicious, especially after the Eichmann operation, that was the toughest part of the mission.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605. And is it Jacob Medid? Is he the one who leads the mission? Is that correct?
That's right. His nickname was Mio inside the operation, inside the agency. He'd grown up in Germany. He spoke German fluently. He sort of knew the mindset of German officers and SS officers. And he'd also lost both his parents in the Holocaust. So there was kind of a personal motive for his participation. I spoke to one ex-Mossad guy who knew Mio well, and he said for him it was sort of like writing the last chapter in the book about his parents' murders, that this gave him a chance to sort of close the book on that horrific event in his childhood.
So how was Zucchers ultimately brought to justice?
Well, my dad went to Brazil in 1964, posing as an Austrian businessman, and found Zucchers, who was operating a small sort of boat rental business in the marina. And he just told him, I'm looking to invest in the tourist business. I need a local point man. You know, we can make you rich. And he was just a very charming guy. So over the course of many conversations, he kind of enticed Zucchers into believing this myth that this was going to be sort of the last chance at the golden ring for him, that he's going to become rich and respected again, which is something he very much desired. So they played out sort of this whole kind of play where they would go and look at rental properties and tourist properties and gradually convinced Zucchers that he was part of a legitimate business. And finally, Mio enticed him to Uruguay, saying, I want to, you know, expand our market. I want to look at different countries. And so they got him to Montevideo, the capital, and there was a Mossad kill team working there, waiting there for him. And they got him into a house, and after a really intense struggle in which Zucchers almost defeated the Mossad team, they were able to assassinate him.
Did it have much of a ripple in the international press, Zucchers' assassination?
Yeah, it really did. I mean, if you were watching sort of the French TV news around those days, when it was finally revealed that he had been killed, it led the news. It was sort of the first or second story. Same story really all over the world. And in Germany, that was really the sort of focus of the mission. There were a lot of newspaper articles about it. The story of what Zukers had done during the war, the 30,000 people he'd helped kill, that really got out there into sort of the public consciousness and into the consciousness of the legislators who were going to sort of vote up or down on the amnesty. That's really what the Mossad mission was aimed at, to get this statute of limitations defeated.
How much would you place the influence of this assassination on getting the statute of limitations defeated?
I mean, I think it played a role, probably a small but essential role. I think one of the things that helped with this this sort of overall mission of getting the amnesty defeated was pressure from Germany's allies, who said, you know, you just can't do this. You're going to sort of ruin everything you've done in the last 20 years to dispel this image of the old Germany, this Nazi image. So I think that was, that was probably the main part of the vote. But even in the days just before the vote was taken in the Bundestag, they had public opinion polls, and it showed there was a majority of Germans in favor of the statute of limitations. So it was not a done deal by any means, and we just can't say what would tip the balance psychologically for these legislators. I do think that this image of the Zukers' history in the war played a part with certain key legislators to get them to vote against the amnesty.
Something really interesting about your book is the discussion of how different European nations reckon with their own past in World War II. And you'd mentioned that initially Germany wanted to depict its nation as falling under the spell of Hitler and a few other key people, but the populace itself was somewhat innocent. France wanted to depict almost all of its nation as being actively involved in the French underground. Latvia, though, that's not a nation I have any sort of sense on. So how was it trying to depict its past in World War II, and how does Zucker play into this mythologizing?
Well, what was interesting about Latvia was that it was actually seen as kind of a haven for Jews fleeing Germany and other places during the war. There was not a lot of history of pogroms or anti-Jewish hatred there compared with the other Eastern European countries. So it was kind of a sanctuary, really. So after the war, I think Latvians really portrayed themselves as victims of both the Soviets and the Germans and didn't really want to face up to their own participation in the massacres. That was common for a lot of Eastern European countries. And what's interesting is that Zukers has really been rehabilitated by the far right in Latvia, even today. There was a musical about him in 2014 where he was portrayed almost as like a James Bond figure, kind of a dashing hero who did what he had to do during the war to help his nation, which was completely inaccurate. So there is this sort of almost nostalgia for Zukers today on the right in Latvia. And I think it fits in with the current rise in anti-Semitism all across Europe, that people even who are confronted with the facts of what happened during the war want to kind of turn their eyes to a brighter picture, a more nostalgic picture, instead of facing the truth.
Well, that's an important point about the relevance that your story has. And do you think that there are any other points of relevance that the story has on events today?
Well, I do think, you know, one thing that fascinated me about Zukers, as we talked about, is how quickly he turned. And that we think that, you know, people's sort of idealism or their convictions will make them sort of immune to the hatred that the Nazis profess. Whereas Zukers turned very quickly because of his own personal risk in the war. I just think it's kind of an illustration that, under pressure, people behave very differently than what we'd like them to behave. So there are heroes certainly among the Latvians. There are people in the book who hid Jews, who saved them. But I think it's a reminder that, sort of the terror of that era is never really too far away from even our modern history.
Absolutely. Very good point. Well, there's a lot more to explore in this story, and your book is called The Good Assassin, How a Mossad Agent and a Band of Survivors Hunted Down the Butcher of Latvia. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, listeners. Well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.